It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for June 5th, 2021. Summer is almost here, and perhaps you're ready to renew vacation plans that might have been thwarted due to the pandemic last year. In February of 2020, we spoke with Ellie Sias from Cycle of Life Adventures as she explained what it was taking to get even the smallest group on tour. Now, bicycle touring is opening up again after the 15 or so months of shutdown, and Ellie's business is not only open, it's booming. With an already 80% full rate on many of her tours, Ellie and I talk about three of her many wonderful adventures, including the Asheville Fundo, the Bluegrass and Bourbon Tours, oh yeah, we're up for that, and the new 33-day epic Mighty Mississippi Tour. Ellie will be with me in the second half of the show. First up, though, is Clarice Lorenzini. In an article she wrote for TeamUSA.org's triathlon site on May 19th, Clarice says, quote, "I'm Clarice Lorenzini, and I'm here to make a difference," end quote. As the only Asian-American pro triathlete on the Ironman circuit, Clarice is bound and determined to race proud as a member of the AAPI community, as well as give back to the cycling community at large with ongoing advocacy. Our conversation today runs the gamut from where she grew up and went to college, in New York, to what she does in addition to racing and coaching, and we get into some depth about why more Asian Americans aren't racing on the pro circuit and why it's important that we talk about it. Racing her first Ironman as a sponsored pro in Tulsa recently, apropos as it coincided with the commemoration of the Tulsa Massacre, Clarice and I delve into what it's like to stand on the start line and not see anyone who looks like you. Hi, Clarice. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
And it's my pleasure talking with you. I would like to begin with your background, where you grew up, what got you into sports, and what kind of work you're doing outside of training and racing triathlons.
Yeah, of course. So for starters, I am originally born in New York. My parents are still in downstate New York. We're from Putnam County, so about 45 minutes north of New York City. But I spent a lot of time during my undergraduate and graduate years up in Syracuse, New York. So I got my undergrad there and then went to a state school for graduate school. And what got me into sports, I think I was in first grade, my mom signed me up for the local soccer league. And I did soccer up until about sixth grade. And it was more of my mom really pushed me towards this. She's like, you need a sport, you need to be healthy. So I played soccer, but I was the goalie. So I did enjoy it, but then in sixth grade, I actually switched into lacrosse, and I loved lacrosse. I played that up until my senior year of high school, but in high school, I transferred high schools my junior year. It was actually my junior year in which I decided to join the cross-country team, and I did winter track and played lacrosse, and it was then that I fostered my love of running there. So I ran in high school. I wasn't very good at it. It was more of a way for me to get some new friends at the school that I was at. And that later translated into my triathlon story. I found running a little bit later again in life in college. Used it as a coping skill. Found triathlon through collegiate triathlon at Syracuse. And now I'm here. But what kind of work I do other than racing triathlons and training? So I actually also coach part-time, or I guess full-time almost. I'm a coach with a club called Speed Sherpa, and my full-time job is actually I work as a recreation therapist for one of the East Coast Substance Abuse Rehabilitation Programs for the United States Navy. I am based out of Naval Medical Center, Portsmouth.
Wow.
Yeah.
So clearly you have not enough to do.
right?
Oh, no. Luckily, I say it luckily, but it's kind of unlucky. I don't want to sound horrible. My husband is currently deployed and has been deployed the past 8 months out of 12. So I really need to keep myself busy. Otherwise, I sit on my couch and think about how much I miss him.
I would guess so.
He's coming home soon, luckily. He's ending his time there, so I'm super excited.
But he'll stay in the Navy?
Yep. He's going to actually try and make a career out of it, try and be a 20-year guy. So.
Oh, good for him. Good for him.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm proud of him.
And, of course, everybody thanks him for his service. Oh, you have a puppy.
I do. I saw that was one of your questions later on. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It is one of my questions later on. And I just spoiled it. But everybody knows I ask those questions. So whatever. I'm not worried about it. So
they just wanted to introduce themselves earlier on. They didn't want to feel left out.
Oh, there's more than one.
There's two. Yep.
We lost one last year, so we have one.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I know. My husband's heart is still broken. Almost every day he thinks about her and just he's so sad. But I'm not getting another one yet. He's saying, no, I'm not ready. I'm like, you're never ready. You know?
It just has to come into your life.
That's right. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Clarice Lorenzini. She's a pro triathlete. She works with the U.S. Navy in a substance abuse rehabilitation program. And, mm-hmm. and I don't really want to talk about that too much, but
yeah.
I do want to know how that work might inform some of the things we're going to talk about later. So I'm going to hold that for a moment, if that's okay with you.
Of course.
So I do want to talk a little bit about Speed Sherpa. Mm-hmm. The subtitle is Mindful Coaching. I'm a yoga teacher, so mindfulness is a very important part of my work. How is that program different from what we might know about other coaching modalities?
Yeah, of course. Great question. So with Speed Sherpa, I think one of the greatest things that sets us apart and some of the feedback that I've even gotten from other athletes is that our biggest aspect is communication. If we're not communicating with our clients or they're not communicating with us, we are not coaching. So we want to be aware. That's where that whole mindfulness component comes in of what's going on in their daily life. So how are they feeling? How did the workouts feel? Did they sleep well? Or all sorts of aspects. Because at the end of the day, it's more than just the workout that you're putting in. It's I think, so big. It's if you're not getting enough sleep, if you're not eating well, are you stressed? There's so many different factors that go into that. So just being aware of all these factors and the bigger picture at the end of the day that, you know, it's just not just physical activity, it's mental. There's so much more going on.
Very interesting. And of course, all of that is true. I mm-hmm. used to, you know, tell cyclists who were just starting to train, you know, wake up in the morning, take your pulse. How many hours did you sleep? So I was doing those things before all of these coaching things. And of course, this goes back almost 40 years. But I see that those things are so important. Being able to look back, I imagine you have them keep some sort of a diary so that they can go, wow, that's why I didn't feel good that day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the biggest thing that I tell athletes or anybody that I work with is I want always, always an open line of communication. My phone is always open, email, if you need to call me or text me, I want to know how you're feeling. So of course, there are the metrics on Training Peaks. If you're familiar with that program, you can input things in there. But I actually love talking to the athletes almost each and every day. And just letting them know that, like, hey, how are you feeling? How did this workout feel? Are you doing okay? Just check-ins almost daily. It's such a big component to me as a coach because that's what I loved when I was being coached is when I had really open and honest feedback with the individual that was coaching me. So I've adapted that into my coaching philosophy.
There goes my dog.
Oh.
But what's interesting is I'll be able to cut that out.
Oh, no.
All right, Ella, stop. Stop. So I want to talk about congratulations, your debut as a pro triathlete with Ironman Tulsa, which was, what, a week ago, I think?
It was that last Sunday. It was about a week before then. So I think it's been about 10 days since,
yeah.
10 or 11 days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting place that you did that, given the publicity about Tulsa this past week.
Yes, the 100-year anniversary of the massacres.
Right. And mm-hmm. one of the things that I really want to talk about with you is the fact that you are the only actively competing Asian American female on the pro triathlon circuit. How is that possible?
It's very interesting that you mentioned that. And it's so I'm the only active Asian American female professional triathlete on the Ironman circuits. It has come to my attention that there is another Asian American female professional triathlete. She is Korean, but I do believe that her focus is more on short course. So I have actually been really lucky that the first Asian American professional female triathlete, her name is Jocelyn Wong Neal. She found me through social media, and we've been following each other for a few years. And we most recently, when I turned pro, I've sought a lot of advice for her, especially with having this platform now that I am one of the sole Asian American female professional triathletes. Again, the only one on the Ironman circuit. And we ask ourselves, like, why is this? And it's something that I even talked about in Triathlete Magazine a few months ago. I think there's a lot to it. I identify, my mother is Filipino, so I am half Filipino. And I know that each Asian culture has different barriers. So I can't speak for everybody. I only speak on behalf of the Filipino culture. But for starters, I know with my mom growing up, and it's the largest thing that we have thought of when I was talking to my mother about this, is that the Filipinos, they don't really know how to swim. They never swam for leisure or for fitness like we might, but rather they swam for survival. So my grandparents grew across, have a house across from the ocean. And you would think my mother knew how to swim, my grandparents, my uncles, they didn't. They knew how to, the just basic swimming so that they can fish, that they can go in and wade enough that they can put a net in, cast the line or cast the spear and get their dinner for the evening or bring it to the market and sell that food. Because that's what's giving that's what they are selling in order to provide for their families. That's such a large component of it.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. So
yeah.
Were you afraid to swim?
I wasn't. And that's so funny that you talk about that, because I actually grew up on a lake. My parents, we weren't lakefront property, but we were right across the street from it. And about half a mile down the road, we had this nice beach. There's a lot of beaches where my parents are from in New York. I was actually a waterfront lifeguard for so long in my life, but my mom was actually scared of me swimming. I loved swimming. I would sneak down to the lake and swim with my friends. My mom actually, up until I was probably about 10 years old, if you can imagine that, my mother would make me swim out to the deep end of our lake with a life vest while the 6 and 7 year olds are going fearless without their vest. And my mother would be screaming from the shore, be like, life vest, Clarice, life vest. I'm like, I know what I'm doing, mom. I loved it. I had swim lessons when I was younger, but we just continued them after a year. And I just went to the lake almost every single day as a child when I was younger. But my mom just, you know, gritting her teeth on the shore, just thinking that unfortunately that I was going to drown.
Poor mom.
I never did.
Of the three sports, is swimming your best sport?
Oh, gosh, no. Oh, no.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm glad to hear that, because it's not the one that is usually the winner.
No, oh, gosh, no. And that's a whole other story when I talk about my swim at Tulsa. But swimming is actually my worst. I'm working so, so hard to improve on it. It's hard. You make such marginal or such little gains, and then it only takes off 2 minutes off your grand total time. But my love, my one true love, and luckily, other than it being my love, it's my best sport, is the run.
And running, of course, is a way to make up a lot more time than swimming. But cycling,
Absolutely. How
is your cycling?
Decent. I'd like to say decent. So I'm really lucky. So the past few years, in the start of my triathlon career, I was actually on a bike that was about two sizes too big for me.
Mm.
But I was definitely... I was definitely more for the aesthetics. And when I was in collegiate triathlon, I fell in love with this Quintana Roo pink camo bike. And in grad school, I remember finding it on a random website, a random bike shop in Minnesota or somewhere in the Midwest. And it was like $800. I drained my bank account because I was a broke grad student at the time. And I just, the bike never fit me properly, no matter what we did. So this year, luckily, finally, my bike mechanics were like, all right, let's get you a bike that fits. So this year, I've made some really good gains on the bike. I feel more powerful. I'm working on a little bit more of an aerodynamic position now, too. I'm getting another bike fit in a few weeks to dial that in. But to actually be on a bike that fits for me and that I know I can unleash my potential on there. Like that to me, even just that mental aspect, I'm like, all right, I got this. I'm going to become a better biker.
Well, and cycling is the place to make up time.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, without a doubt.
All right, we're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, we're going to speak with Clarice some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I am speaking with pro triathlete Clarice Lorenzini, and she has turned pro recently. She is the only actively competing Asian American female on the long pro triathlon circuit, meaning Ironman circuit. Ironman races are just insane. I don't know how you guys do it. I do want to change the subject a bit. I want to know what you think might be holding other Asian American women back from this sport and bicycling too. Now, full disclosure, Bike Law is your sponsor and Bike Law also sponsors my show. And Rachel Maney, of course, is Asian American.
Yep.
And she is a triathlete, as I remember, as well as an avid cyclist. So, you know, few and far between. What's holding you back, or what's holding other Asian American women back?
Again, I can only speak mainly for the Filipinos on this aspect. But as I said, that large barrier with swimming wasn't a means for exercise or recreation. It was for survival. But also to another thing, and it's my mother heavily, as I was growing up, really promoted education. And my mother immigrated over here from the Philippines. She spent her whole life over there. She came over at about the age of 26. So she wanted better for, she wanted more for me. She wanted me to, you know, be a doctor. She wanted me to go on and get really good degrees and make good money, because my mother worked so hard, had a hard life in the Philippines, in a third world country, a developing country. And then she comes over to America, where there's this promise of being so grand and all of that, that there was such a large focus on education. It was, sports came second. You don't focus on your sports, you know, even if it was your source of recreation or leisure. As a child, it was an outlet. Even as a teenager, for me, that's how I coped. That's how I made friends. It's, at the end of the day, it came down to largely, you have to get into a good university, good graduate school, medical school, law school, whatever it may be, and then go on to become, you know, very successful and make a lot of money in life to later support your parents that worked so hard for you. But aside from that aspect, I think one of the largest things, and I've received a lot of messages lately, and it's very heartwarming. It you know, when times are tough, it really reminds me why I'm doing what I do. But representation, it's hard to go out there and put yourself out there on a platform or at races where you don't see other people that are like you. And especially, it's been so hard for the AAPI community this past year with the coronavirus, with a lot of comments being made about how the Asians are responsible for this. It's the China flu, and then unfortunately the horrible attacks in March in Atlanta, and afterwards AAPI crime just spiked. You know, there was the woman that the Filipino, the elderly Filipino woman on her way to church that got attacked right outside an apartment building. And even my bike mechanic is Filipino himself, and he says that lately he's been getting a lot of side eyes. He's been followed in the stores. So it's just very scary to put ourselves out there and think that you know, we are different. We look different. It's and if there's places where other people aren't there for us, we don't have another person. Like, I didn't have another Asian woman with me on the start line that I could identify with and think, okay, like, we're going through the same thing together. She understands what I feel like. And I'm the only one there. So I have to fend for myself. It's tough. It's hard. And I think largely not having somebody out there or again, just some cultural barriers are really preventing us from, you know, being out there more in the cycling and triathlon world.
Have you experienced any direct discrimination in the sport?
No, I haven't. And I have talked to Triathlete Magazine and USA Triathlon about that. And the sport has been absolutely, absolutely welcoming. The feedback, especially that I've gotten the past month with the platform that I've developed and my story has been amazing. And so many people have been willing to share it for me. So no, I haven't. And I'm thankful for that. But just because I haven't experienced it on the sport doesn't mean that it isn't out there, that it isn't, unfortunately, on some people's minds or there are some thoughts that are running out there.
Right. And we will link that story in our blog. Oh, yeah. You know, when the show gets published this weekend. I want a little bit of a segue in. You're doing some things with bike law. And you're taking up road safety. You're taking on road safety, I should say. How are you doing that? I mean, it is such an important part of our cycling life. And Rachel is so unbelievably immersed in it. How are you doing and what are you doing to take on road safety for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it goes both ways. I think that you need to have an educational component with it. Like, you need to go out there. You need to educate other people. You need to advocate for other cyclists. But you also need to, it's that talk the talk, walk the walk. The largest thing for me is even in college, even my own parents, up in New York, there's a lot of cyclists, a lot of triathletes. Not as many that I've seen around in the Virginia Beach area, but I'll go into that in just a little bit. But when I had friends be like, oh, that cyclist, they're on the road, they're so annoying. And I say, you know, that's somebody's family member, that's somebody's friend, that's somebody's dad, aunt, uncle, mom. We are people too at the end of the day, and we deserve to absolutely be respected. And then on the flip side, I think to myself, we absolutely deserve as cyclists to also be smart on the roads. Unfortunately, in Virginia Beach, there's a lot of the cycling here isn't very good. I do have to travel about 30 minutes to an hour to go on a ride, which is quite unfortunate. I really wish it could be just me leaving outside my house. But I do that so that I can be safe, that I can be on safe roads with cars versus some of the roads around here don't have shoulders. They're highways that are 55, 65 miles per hour. And I know that as much as I wanted to be on that road, it's just not safe for me. It's not safe for the cars there too. God forbid there's a pothole and I need to swerve out of the way. So I get, even with me, I have a lot of patients that really wanted to get into cycling and all that, and they're scared of the roads too. And, you know, I tell them, we have the rights of the road. We deserve to be treated just like any other vehicle out there. But at the same time, we want to show these communities, especially these cities that we're riding in, that we deserve the respect and that we can ride on the road safely and coexist with other vehicles.
All of that is true. And I'm hoping that as numbers of cyclists grow, the visibility will make people a little more inclined, and also calming streets, you know, doing some of the street calming urban planning that's going on. We're having that happening right here in my little community. They are actually taking a 4-lane and turning it into a 2-lane. And I'm excited. Well, to put bike lanes in the sides. And it's so exciting. It's so exciting.
That's awesome. That's where the advocacy definitely comes into play. And my previous job, I actually worked for city government. So my director was very familiar with the fact that I was a triathlete and that I would ride my bikes on the road. And that was one of the large components that is the city of Portsmouth, Virginia. They're actually later, I believe it was 2 years ago, voted a cycling friendly community, but they do have a lot of bike lanes, but it was asked for by the community. And it's not, you know, they're not on sidewalks, they're not specific bike paths, but they're a part of the road where, again, it was, you know, a 2-lane road or something that was condensed into something a little bit smaller so that people can safely ride downtown or be with their families or commute to the store or something like that. So again, as I keep saying, and I keep repeating it, that advocacy, knowing, telling our cities that we are here, that we want some change, that we deserve the respect on the, we deserve respect and we deserve to be on the road.
All that said, what is your next event?
So I am actually going to be racing in about, oh gosh, it's like 24 days, about 3 weeks. Oh no, my body is still feeling the Ironman. I'm going to be racing Revolution 3 Williamsburg in Williamsburg, Virginia. It is a 70.3 distance triathlon. So I guess the short course of the long course.
The half Ironman.
Yeah, yep, half Ironman, correct. So I'm really looking forward to it since it's in Williamsburg. That's actually about 1 hour away from me. So
ooh,
it's a
nice
local race. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's nice. Very, very nice.
Yeah, I'm excited.
It's just been really fun to talk with you and to sort of catch the enthusiasm. I mean, it is contagious listening to you. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
So I have three questions I ask my fun guests. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. What's your favorite food?
This is oddly specific. Very oddly specific. And a lot of people are like, okay, Clarice, this is weird. So there is a grocery store chain called Wegmans, if you're familiar with
it. I am familiar with Wegmans.
Okay. I learned about it when I was in college, my undergrad at Syracuse.
Because you were in Syracuse, right?
Yes. Yeah. So it started right out. It's from upstate New York. And I truly have no idea how I discovered this food item, but they have this frozen ravioli. It's just frozen cheese ravioli. And I don't know what it is about that. It is my favorite food in the whole entire world. Not like cheese ravioli in general, specifically Wegmans brand frozen cheese ravioli.
So do you have it in your freezer right now?
I always have a bag.
Of course you do.
Always.
What kind of music do you like to listen to?
Play? I used to play the clarinet when I was younger, if that counts. But I phased out of that in high school. Wasn't the greatest at it. My dad still hopes to this day that I'll pick my clarinet back up. It's still at their house. But this is also another odd one. I really enjoy tropical house music.
What is it?
Tropical house music.
Oh, tropical house music. I thought you said tropical health, and I'm like, okay, that's a new one for me. Tropical house music.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
It's like that dancey, that instance, I guess, that a lot of people don't really like. I like it because the beat is really good, especially for working out. But it has a lot of the, again, the tropical vibes, a lot of the and I don't know the name of it, but the bamboo flute. There we go. It has a lot of bamboo flute incorporated into it. And it's relaxing, but at the same time, upbeat. It's actually been something that I've liked for a few years now. It's a small little genre, but it's so good.
I love it. I love it. And we already know you have pets. So tell me about your pets.
Yes, I have two. So I have two dogs. I have two pit bulls. One is named Apollo. He is our male. And I have a girl named Yenko, who is actually, I have to brag about her, she actually only has one eye.
Oh,
Yeah, but she's still amazing.
We had a three-legged dog once, and that dog was fast.
Oh.
I could never catch him. He was so fast when he wanted to get away. They adapt so well.
Oh, yeah. She was blind probably since the age of one, is what our previous owner told us. But so she hasn't had sight in so long that it doesn't really bother her, except when she clonks her head sometimes when she moves too fast. But I do the same. So.
Right, exactly. I mean, what makes us any different, right?
Exactly.
Well, this has just been delightful. Clarice, thank you so much for talking with me. We've been speaking with Clarice Lorenzini. You can follow her at, I think it's ClariceLorenzini.net. Is that right?
So my website is ClariceLorenzini.com.
.com.
My Instagram is just Clarice Lorenzini. And then I'm on Facebook as Clarice Lorenzini-Triathlete.
Okay. And we will tag that article that you wrote for USA Triathlon. I'm Clarice Lorenzini, and I'm here to make a difference. And you clearly do. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. You have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Clarice Lorenzini joined me from her home in Virginia. Okay. Tropical house music. I had to look it up and play some. And she's right. She's absolutely right. It's got a great beat, nothing heavy, and you really do want to dance. So if you're interested, you can follow Clarice on Instagram at Clarice Lorenzini and on Facebook at Clarice Lorenzini Triathlete. A link to her article on TeamUSA.com's site for May 19th, titled "I'm Clarice Lorenzini and I'm Here to Make a Difference," can be found on our website, OutspokenCyclist.com, for the June 5th episode. Let's take a break, and when we return, we'll speak with Ellie Sias from Cycle of Life Adventures. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. If you are ready to head out for a guided tour, Ellie Sias, owner of Cycle of Life Adventures, has a lot of options for you. From her Asheville Fundo to the newly minted Mighty Mississippi Tour, an epic 33-day adventure from north to south, Ellie has rebounded from the pandemic lockdowns to bring some exciting trips to you. Hi, Ellie. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's really good to catch up with you in a year where we might be actually able to get out and tour.
Hello and good morning, Diane. Nights of that again. Yes.
Yes. We spoke February of 2020 and things were, you know, really dismal in some ways. And now I think we're seeing some real changes for 2021. And I'm really excited to see some of the adventures that Cycle of Life is offering. So tell me what's changed for you in the last 15 months.
Oh, Diane, It's an absolute turnaround in business. People in the United States are ready to travel. They have been cooped up for so long. We're overwhelmed with business right now. Most of our trips are completely booked, if not overbooked, through this entire year of 2021.
Wow.
And it's just amazing. We've gone out and purchased additional vans. We've hired additional guides. And it's just gangbusters. So for a small business to have exploded like this has been very exciting for us.
While it's exciting, my guess is it has also presented a few challenges. Tell me some of the things that you have had to juggle to make all of these what look like magnificent trips work, because you have a lot of epic tours this year, long tours.
We do. We have added a new epic trip as well. I think our biggest issue in running trips in the last 15 months has been our service providers. And the general public should probably be aware of this as well. You know, the hotels and restaurants simply cannot operate the way that they had in the past. Last year, during COVID, we had limited numbers of tours that we did deliver, but we were very selective as to the locations of those tours because of COVID and local restrictions. So we had to make sure that we were in rural areas where the COVID numbers were low. We had to make sure that we were in towns with strict mandates, and all of our guests for the last 15 months had to have a negative test ahead of time, which means they have to test 3 days prior to their trip starting. And now we actually have all of our guests either testing negative or having to have had a vaccine. With COVID over the last year, so many of the service providers lost their employees. They simply could not keep them on. And now they are suffering and not being able to service the hospitality industry. Our biggest challenge has been restaurants, and still remains as restaurants and hotels. Many of the hotels don't have enough workers to prepare the rooms and turn them over from one day to the next. So any guest in any with any tour company or just anyone traveling needs to be aware that to just chill for a moment and let these hospitality folks catch up and just be patient with them. They'll get you into your room or they'll get your dinner to you, but they are very, very shorthanded.
So do you think that the ability to hire has changed? Where have the workers gone? Many of them went on unemployment. Are they able to pay them more money to come back? I know that's a big issue here in Ohio that people are saying, well, I'm making more on unemployment than I did working at even, places like some of our finer restaurants that are trying to reopen.
You know, we've been on the road now since January of this year, and we've just heard a number of different reports from different states and different municipalities. We've even heard in some locations where restaurants and service industries are paying bonuses for people to come back to work and to come off of unemployment. And I don't know how much truth there is to that, but we certainly do need to get some folks back to work. And those of us in the travel industry are just anxious to get back to the way our tours used to run. I'm just not sure that we'll ever be back to that here in the U.S. I think it could possibly take another year or two. But that's just my opinion. It's tough to say.
Well, I'm not sure you're wrong, because in our business, in the bicycle business, we're being told that the supply chain will not open fully so that we can actually depend upon getting the components and parts for the bikes we need until 2024. So we're talking another, 2.5 years.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
It is amazing.
And I just spoke with a bike dealer a few weeks ago. I was trying to get my hands on a couple additional e-bikes. They don't have any e-bikes coming in for a year and a half.
Right. And that's what I mean. Right.
Yeah.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Ellie Sias. She is the co-owner, if not the owner, of Cycle of Life Adventures. We spoke with Ellie back in February of 2020 when things were really dismal, and now they're hopping and exciting, but there are some glitches that are going to have to be overcome. Are you finding enough guides, Ellie? How is your employee situation?
We are finding guides, and most of our guides are folks who have come to us over the years as former guests or bicycle mechanics, people that we have dealt with for the last 9.5 to 10 years, and they too are my age and retired, and they're looking for additional income or, a part-time situation. And this is ideal for them because they still get to go out and do something that they love, and they're a big help to us. So it has worked out well for us.
That's great. Great. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about some of the tours that you're offering this season. First of all, I love the way the website looks. It's really nice the way you've blocked each tour and you kind of just hover over it, and beautiful photographs, very inviting. So I wanted to talk about three in particular. One is the Asheville Fundo. For some reason, it just sounded like a really fun one. And then, of course, one of the reasons that you were brought to my attention again is your new epic 33-day tour of the Mississippi River, which sounds fabulous. And I also want to talk about the Bluegrass and Bourbon Tour. That's a personal interest to me.
Oh, good.
So let's start with the Asheville Fundo.
Okay.
Tell us about that tour.
We started the concept of a fundo several years ago, and Asheville was our first fundo. And the idea here is to bring to folks a tour that comes in at a little lesser price than a fully all-inclusive tour. But we stay at one location. Some people call it a hub and spoke tour. Even though it says it's a fundo, it's meant to be fun. It's not a timed event or a race. They can ride as much or as little as they want. And each night they go back home to the hotel of their choice or their grandmother's house or a friend's apartment. Each day we ride, we offer two different routes, a shorter, easier route and a longer, perhaps more difficult route. We also throw in a few little perks and some added fun activities. Like in Asheville, we do a beer tour at one of the local breweries, and it's exciting and it's a fun little tour. Our nice feature of this tour is the Biltmore, and Biltmore Estate is probably the biggest attraction in Asheville, North Carolina. It's the home of George Vanderbilt, and it is open to the public. It's a wonderful tour. It's on 2,500 acres, I believe, and you tour the Biltmore Mansion, the gardens, and we do ride our bikes on the property. There's a wine tour. It's a nice, nice tour. And so we include that in our package.
And you're also offering a perk for that tour. So right now I noticed that if two people sign up, there's a little bonus available.
Yeah. We have an offer online. If someone signs up with a friend, they each get $100 off of that tour. So,
which they can spend on more wine.
That's right. Or go back to the Biltmore at one evening for a candlelight tour or something.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And Asheville's an exciting town. It really is.
I've never been there.
Oh, you need to go. It's a vibrant little town, city. It's just a great artist community. There are lots of activities. There's hiking and biking and river rafting and just lots and lots to do there. And it's a young, diverse population, just a fun city. We go there multiple times a year. It's just wonderful.
Once again, we're speaking with Ellie Sias. She is the owner of Cycle of Life Adventures Touring Company. Actually, you're out of the South Carolina area, right?
We are in the mountains of North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina, the other Carolina.
In a small little mountain town called Blowing Rock.
Nice. That sounds nice.
A wonderful location. Mm-hmm.
So the other one before we get to the Mighty Mississippi Tour, and maybe we should take a short break first. Yeah, let's do that. We'll take a short break and we'll come back and talk with Ellie some more. We're going to talk about the Bluegrass and Bourbon Tour and the Mighty Mississippi. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm speaking with Ellie Sias. She is one of the owners of the Cycle of Life Adventures Touring Company. We spoke with her in 2020. Things weren't looking the way they are today. And so we spoke at the beginning of our conversation about their Asheville Fundo. We didn't give a date for that, Ellie. We should give a date.
It is June the 25th, so it's coming up in just about a month.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's quick. And then I want to talk about the Kentucky Bluegrass and Bourbon Tour. So my husband and I are bourbon people, and we have really, really good friends in Kentucky whom we have not seen in 2 years because of COVID. So it looks like you're going to go down there and do some riding and drinking. Tell me a little bit about the Bluegrass and Bourbon Tour. And of course, it's horse country.
It is. And actually, we run this tour two times a year, once as a fundo type of a tour, and that happens starting this Friday. And then in the fall, we run it as a full tour covering most of the metro Lexington area. But the Bluegrass Tour starts and stops in northern Lexington. So it includes the really beautiful, beautiful horse farms of northern Lexington. We go to the Keeneland Racetrack and have breakfast at the Jockey's Kitchen with the jockeys and all the horse folks. We do a little tour at Woodford Reserve, which is one of the bourbon distilleries. The thing with the bourbon tours this year, they have been shut down for the last 15 months, and the bourbon distilleries are just now starting to reopen. The issue with them now is most of them are only offering a tasting rather than a full tour. And apparently there is a shortage of bottles for them to bottle the bourbon in.
Go figure.
You know, such details.
Right.
But the bourbon tours are very interesting, and they walk, each one of them has their own spiel. You know, Wild Turkey is a different tour than Maker's Mark, and Maker's Mark is different than Woodford. So if you're a bourbon connoisseur, I would suggest to you that you take a couple of days and tour several of the distilleries. Most of them are very entertaining, and they're educational. It's really interesting to watch the process of, you know, this big vat of corn boiling, and it's just very difficult to believe that this big bowl of corn soup turns into mash that creates, you know, bourbon. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
It is. And we are bourbon people. And what's so interesting to us is people say, well, just, you know, when it's very scarce, which some of them are right now, well, can't they just make more? People don't understand how long it takes to age these bourbons.
Does.
When they say 15 years, they mean 15 years. They don't open those barrels.
Right. And all over Kentucky, you will find these, each distillery has these huge warehouses. And I believe the name of them is a Rick House.
Something like that. Yeah.
Tall buildings. And they just have thousands and thousands of barrels stored in there for years. And these barrels are rotated and moved around constantly so that the bourbon ages just properly. It's a very, very interesting tour.
It is. It is.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. So I definitely do not want to give short shrift to this mighty Mississippi tour. It just sounds so interesting. The only time we've been on the Mississippi was coming back from Ragbri, and it was the last night, and we camped right outside, you know, on the one side, I guess the west side of the Mississippi. Tell us about this 33-day epic tour of the Mississippi River. Where does it start on the river, and where does it end, and when is it?
Okay. This is a new tour for us this year. It is the first time ever running it. We have scouted this out and designed it with the help of Bob Robinson, who's the author of a book called A Bicycling Guide for the Mississippi River Road. It starts in northern Minnesota at the headwaters of the Mississippi at Lake Itasca, and it ends in New Orleans. And it is 33 days. We cover, let me think if I can name all of the states here. Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, Kentucky, Arkansas, Tennessee, Louisiana, Mississippi. I think that's everything. And we have divided this tour into four stages so that you can choose one stage or all four stages, or stage two and three, or three and four. We have our break days, and where we pick up new guests are in the cities of St. Paul and St. Louis, Memphis. We do an additional break day in Vicksburg so that people can tour the battlefield and just have a rest day, an additional rest day. This tour averages about 65 miles per day for cycling for these 33 days. And our break days are in major cities, in the downtown areas next to the river. And we include a little something special for them each day where we have a break. So like in Memphis, we'll do a downtown tour. In New Orleans, we do a little tour around the Lafayette cemeteries and a number of different things. We have a few days in the middle in the states of Iowa, Illinois, Kentucky, where they're remote farming communities that are along the river. So we have big days just to find the next hotel.
Sure.
So we have days of, 100-mile ride per day. But then other days it'll be a modest 40 to 60.
So how many people will you accommodate on, let's say, each of the four segments as opposed to the total tour? Because that could change.
We would like to have somewhere between 8 and 12 on each segment. And the reason we're doing that this year is because of COVID, if we have to transport people, we don't want to cram a lot of people into a van. But most our tours are designed so that we're riding from hotel to hotel, and there should be very little time spent as shuttling. And on this tour, we will require that everybody have a vaccine.
You know, it's interesting. I have reopened my yoga studio after 15 months, just last week. Mm-hmm. And that was the way it would work, that everybody would be willing to come back if everybody else was vaccinated. So you just have to go with what works. And I think that's what works. And I also think that cyclists in general are very responsible. I see them as responsible people and looking for, you know, other responsible people to spend their time with. So, yeah, I can see how that would work. Mm-hmm. So is there another tour that I've missed here that you think is especially exciting that maybe we didn't talk about last time? It's funny, when you mentioned the Asheville Fundo, that we talked about it last time, as you started talking, I'm like, we did talk about this. And because it sounded interesting then. So I'm pretty sure, because I remember Biltmore. But anyway, it doesn't matter. People will love to hear it again. So do you have another one that you think is especially different that listeners might want to jump on?
Actually, we do. We have a tour that we started just last year. And it's on the coast of Maine.
Mm.
And it's not your typical coastal Maine bike tour. Most people touring Maine do the southern coast between Portland and Bar Harbor. This tour is covering the Bold, B-O-L-D, coast of Maine. And it's the coast of Maine from Bar Harbor north to the Canadian border at Campobello. And it's a beautiful, beautiful ride. It's an easy ride if people wanted to do it self-supported. There are just a handful of little hotels and motels that you can stop and spend the evening. There aren't too many camping sites, but it's a great little tour because once you get north of the very, very touristy area of Acadia National Park, it begins to get very remote, and the roads are in good shape, but they're still rough and rolling with beautiful, beautiful little harbor towns. And I think that's a good tour. It will be on our schedule for touring for August of this year.
I want people to learn a little more about Cycle of Life Adventures. Tell them how they can find out more, read about the tours, see what other people say, because you do have some of that information. And mm-hmm. and it's just, I mean, I really think the website has just, it's just beautiful. I love it.
Well, thank you. And these pictures are pictures of our guests on tours. And I've also used some professional pictures done by a cycling photographer based out of Missouri. He just does wonderful work. And he does work for myself and back roads and adventure cycling and just a number of different.
Yeah, some of these are breathtaking.
Companies. Yeah, he is really very good. Dennis Filo.
Oh, I know who that is.
Oh,
yeah.
You do?
Oh, of course. Yeah, as soon as you said his name, I know who that is. I should talk to him. That way, he would be fun to talk with.
Oh, he'd be a great interview for you.
Yeah,
yes.
He would be. He would be. So tell my listeners how to find out more, Ellie.
Look up cycleoflifeadventures.com. We're online. We're also in lots of bike shops up and down the East Coast with brochures and things of that sort. We keep a live chat button going each afternoon, so you can chat with a live agent and ask them questions and descriptions of tours, and or just give us a call at the office. We'll help them out.
Well, again, we've been speaking with Ellie Sias. She's the owner of Cycle of Life Adventures. It is just a beautiful website. I think some of her tours sound like it's just time to get out on the road, and this makes you want to do it. Thank you so much for talking with me again, and I hope you have a great summer. I hope some of these restaurants and hotels can find workers so we can have more people doing tours.
Right. Thank you so much.
All right. You have a wonderful afternoon.
Okay. Bye.
Ellie Sias is the co-owner of Cycle of Life Adventures. For more information, to chat with an agent, or to just look at some of the beautiful photos and drool over the trips, you can log on to cycleoflifeadventures.com. My thanks to Ellie and to Clarice Lorenzini for joining me today. Next week, we speak with David Bradford, the fitness editor for Cycling Weekly, as well as some reporting on some news that broke yesterday about big money for bike ped infrastructure. Remember, you can always subscribe to our podcast at your favorite podcast app. Check in with our Facebook page for any of a number of conversations that are going on, and chime in if you'd like. Follow us on Instagram at Outspoken Cyclist, and you can always leave a comment about any episode on our blog site, OutspokenCyclist.com, where every episode is accompanied by a synopsis of the show. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.